All right. So the funny part is, when I was going to UNC, my husband Mike was working at Duke. So there was a season of the year, basketball season, that we didn't talk a whole lot. At least not about basketball. So thanks for inviting me here. I feel like after that worship time, you guys know all you need to know. Seriously. Help us not to just be singing. Move us out into action. So when I talk today, I am telling you my spin on that, okay? And I'm not trying to say this is going to be like this for everyone, but I wanted to, this is so cool for me to have an opportunity just to tell a little bit about my story. Some of it's really personal about how I deal with complex issues. I'm a pediatrician. I love kids. I think we're the happiest of all the doctors because we get to play with toys and like make the goo-goo sound and all that. But that's part of my story, which I'll allude to later, just some of the hard things. And when I talk about the hard things, I want you guys to know that there's a lot of joy in my job, too. I just felt like some of what I wanted you to wrestle with and some of what I have come to wrestle with are the harder, complicated issues. So don't let this be a downer for you. I love what I do, but it's not easy. And so that's why I'm really happy to share with you. I'm sorry I couldn't be here last night. We have three teenagers. Two of them were going to the junior prom. So I was in charge of making the bow tie to sit right and getting them down to where they were taking pictures. And it also involved a really late night. So I wrote out my talk because, A, I tend to wander, and B, I'm tired. Last night, our boys were driving our car, and so we required them to text us and check in at every point. We got there. Not while they were driving. Yeah. After they got to where. So the last text came in at 3:08, which I didn't actually hear, but I did wake up shortly after to check. Just because that's a mom thing, right? And a dad thing. You want to know that they got there, and hopefully then they're having a lot of fun. Okay. So as Mike and I were preparing to talk to you, we're speaking to each other about how, you know, so we're middle-aged, right? We feel like we're less sure of the answers to everything than we were when we were your age. And I think life is like that sometimes. You're more sure of how to do something. So I felt a lot more sure about how I was going to live out my faith before I started practicing medicine than now that I'm in it. But the flip side is also true, that I feel very much more comfortable in doing what I do because I know that God is working through me and it's not about me. So the confidence has sort of shifted. I don't know any of the answers, really, truly. But I think that's the beauty of having experience. And for example, the same was true. I was a much better parent before I had kids. I knew what to do every moment of every day. I knew how to, you know, say no to TV and all that stuff. But now I get it. It's actually really complicated. So the thing that I'm also aware of, though, is that there's a bigger story. There's a bigger picture behind my life. And I'm thankful, I know Mike talked a lot about this, that our view of humanity is mapped onto the story of the gospel. And so what we do is small, but it maps onto a bigger story. And so that's the comfort that we're going to keep coming back to, that we're playing a role in shalom, in healthcare, but we're not the answer to all the issues, okay? So thanks for listening last night. I know I heard that Mike set me up. He's the president of my fan club. It's not a paid position, so but he's also a huge encouragement in my life because he lives what he talked about last night. And when I am falling apart and saying it's not worth it, he reminds me that it is. So let me start with a question to you guys. This is rhetorical. You don't have to say anything. Why did you pick healthcare as a profession? Just think about that for a second. What is it about life and health that you think is worth protecting? And not only protecting, but enhancing. Don't you think it's the notion that Mike talked about, that God sets up humanity to reflect his own life, right? All of humanity, and not just humanity, but the world in general. The Bible tells us in the beginning that God infused into his creation a quality that's so breathtaking, so beautiful, and so treasured that he would later sacrifice his own son to restore that quality to our world. And we, as his children, are called to reflect that in our bodies, but also in our actions and in our calling. In a surprising turn of events, and you guys know the story, the king of creation returned to model this call, not as a chief executive, but as a servant. He didn't come to an office park. He took up the basin and the towel. And he invites us to participate in his life by protecting that life and by serving others. He wants us to be what we call ad life health professionals. So Mike and I have this thing, you guys might not know, what does it mean to be ad life? Well, it's sort of a Kellyism, to be honest. But we've come to use that as a sort of a compliment that we give to someone who lives their faith in a vibrant way. Back when we were young and we knew everything, we were leading a small group and we thought we knew how to do that. It was great. But one night I said to Mike, I hope so-and-so doesn't come tonight. She really sucks the life out of me. And that was just the opposite of what ad life was. In contrast, Mike and I began to think about and admire the people that we were in fellowship with who always seemed to bring life to the gatherings. People who didn't necessarily know all the answers, but had the kind of faith that gave them confidence and grace to be willing to serve. We wanted to seek and pray and try to live that way ourselves. So what does that look like to be a healthcare provider? Well, today I'm just going to share a short part of my story. And I purposely made this a little bit short so that you guys can ask questions. Again, we called it Q&A time, but it might be Q&Q time because I don't know the answers. Okay? And some of you guys might not come to the same conclusion that I've come to about some of these issues. I respect that. Totally fine with that. But the point of me sharing is to sort of give you an idea of, in my life, what is practical theology? What is shalom? What does honoring humanity look like? So as far as the issue of humanity, remember that as a healthcare professional, you'll carry with you a set of expectations. Some you put on yourself, and some society gives you. You're already, no doubt, immersed in a world that tells you that you are smarter and possibly more important than others around you. Your education can make you have a level of arrogance about yourself and your role in practice, in society, in the world. Don't buy into that. Jesus' example, and you guys have been singing about it, is one of humility. And we need to walk there too. No job is too small for you, even if you're the attending physician, okay? If you're already in clinical practice, you might have seen some people who walk this talk. They do things like opening the doors for people. They smile. They speak appreciatively to their staff. They give an extra minute to comfort someone who's sorrowful, either a patient or a coworker. They don't flaunt their knowledge. They look to enhance yours. They don't put other people down, but they find ways to lift and encourage people, always leading the way in service. These are those who add life to their environments, and you know them when you see them because it's rare. This is a daily challenge for me. But I try to remind myself that just as the Bible says, even a cup of cold water, literally, is remembered and is a gift of service in honor of Christ. As well as humility, though, I would remind you that your call is to pursue excellence in your chosen field. A sloppy healthcare provider who does not practice his or her job to the best of their ability is not a great witness. This is your calling, to glorify God with the set of talents he has given you in a manner of humility and to point toward the ultimate life, who's Christ yourself, Christ himself. So humility about us naturally flows into service and respect for our patients. As you can imagine, this is sometimes harder than it seems. I find the gaps between me and my patients, I think, tend to be larger because I'm in an urban context, and also, as was alluded to, I don't always get the American thing. And it takes time to bridge those gaps when you're a healthcare provider between you and your patient. If you choose primary care, the patient-provider relationship sets the stage for that respect and understanding, and usually we have the luxury of time and working together, patient and provider, for a great many years, so you can work on that relationship. But it takes effort. For me, here's how some of the things I do. I try to learn personal things about my patients, and I try to record them so that I can talk about them. Not just medical facts, but personal things, because that makes them real to me. I ask the parents, what does your new baby's name mean? What do you hope for them? What are your dreams for them? I ask kids what subjects they like in school and what they want to be when they grow up. A couple of weeks ago, a little four-year-old, in all seriousness, told me when he grows up, he wants to be a pineapple. And I scratched my head for a moment, but where does that come from? SpongeBob SquarePants, all right, because there's a pineapple character. So here's the other cool thing about pediatrics. You have to watch TV, so you know that. I ask teenagers what books they like to read, what movies they like to see, and what they do with their free time. Is all this a waste of my time? Maybe, because it often achieves no medical purpose. But I believe that when we take time to know our patients and when we invest in that relationship, we're glorifying God's image in them. We're adding life by giving worth and dignity to that individual. And we do that, here's a key thing, regardless of whether or not that person knows that they are reflecting God's image. Most of our patients don't know that. But to do this, I believe, is to call out the true humanity, as Mike was talking about yesterday. And if you build that relationship successfully, you'll earn the right to be heard in other matters later on in their life. Pediatrics is really fun. I get to see people from when they're born to usually, you know, when they go off to college, or I think we age out at 21. I get tired of them around then, but so that you can imagine, if you're in the same place for many years, you get to have long-term relationships. That's the beautiful thing. And I believe, for me, that is a calling. And every time I see them, it might be once a year, I can add to that relationship by respecting them, by asking about them, and by then offering advice. So this is all well and good, right? We learn humility. We treat our patients with respect. It's pretty straightforward. We can honor God's image and seek to serve others. That's easy, right? Well, you guys know. And the hard part, in the grand scheme of things, is that we're caught in this sort of unenviable position. We know, we've seen the birth of wholeness and true shalom in the person of Christ. That happened many years ago. We know his work in our lives, and we see it in the people around us. But the world at large and the vast majority of our patients don't recognize these things. They don't see themselves as mirroring a creator God. They're caught up in lots of worldly stuff, which includes a lot of brokenness. When Jesus spoke to his disciples at the end of his life, he contrasted himself, the good shepherd, with the thief who comes to rob and kill and destroy. He said, I've come that you might have life and have it abundantly. Not just life, but abundant life. We see that often, but those we serve do not. And that makes it complicated, very, very complicated. That's why your context of practicing medicine will matter very much. You need to think about how you live out this tension while you're practicing medicine. Perhaps you'll choose to work in a Christian organization such as Esperanza Health Center in Philadelphia or Christ Community Organization Health Center in Tennessee. both of which are amazing organizations. In that setting, you may speak freely of the gospel and its freeing power. You can confront your patient about God's desire for them as it relates to their health and well-being. You can converse and receive fellowship and support from your colleagues as you share the common mission. But you'll still face those who do not respond to your appeals for them to live a chaste life, who experiment with substances which are harmful and addictive, who expose themselves to sexual infections, and who beat their children out of uncontrolled rage. You must still honor the image of God in them. Treat each one of them with dignity and provide the best medicine for them. You must still honor their privacy and treat them with respect. You are called to bear their burdens and humble yourself as a servant to them, even if they don't recognize why. But perhaps you'll find yourself, as I have, practicing medicine in an urban context and for an organization which is completely secular. And this isn't a slam against where I work, but often organizations nowadays have to be really concerned more about the bottom line than anything else. And surely they're not thinking about how to honor the God image in people. That's not their mission. So you might work with people that you have some common ground with, but probably fellowship isn't the word you would pick. You can't, and this is me, you can't speak the gospel in words so much, clearly, but you try to poke questions. I try to poke questions in the conversation to let people know that I'm a person of faith. I ask kids if they're involved in activities, and I include church in that. I often try to teach people about their bodies, and I explain it that this is how God made it work for you. If I'm teaching them about how to take care of something, I'll put that in there and see if they respond. I wait for the opportunity to respond to something they say about faith, so then I can carry the conversation on. But I'm also often faced with tough ethical situations where there isn't an easy answer. And here are some of my struggles and some of the issues which I face on a day-to-day basis. So I deal with teenagers a lot, and I end up talking about sex a lot. I believe what the Bible says about sex, that it has a proper place in marriage. But I'm faced with and care for the majority of kids who do not have that same moral framework. So, and you might disagree with me here, instead of appealing to them on a right and wrong basis, I try my best to guide them toward chastity by talking about wise decisions, meaningful relationships, respect, future goals, etc. In so doing, I believe that I'm promoting the values that reflect the kingdom of God, even though those teenagers don't necessarily belong to that kingdom yet. If kids are already having sex, and I know this is controversial, I help them work through birth control issues. I know that's a hard thing for maybe everybody to understand, but I feel like I still need to provide medical care and help them protect themselves against further disease. And I feel like I'm still bound to promote the kingdom value of health and wellness in this imperfect situation. See how it's complicated? I don't want to condone the wrongdoing, but I don't also want them to experience further harm and pain from these teens, from their actions. So that's a tough question. I face that every day. And again, you may come to a different conclusion about how you deal with that. I'm just talking about myself. And you might not know this, but a teenager's conversation with their pediatrician is protected information. Nothing, meaning I can't tell the parents about sexual activity or drugs or any behavior that the teen has just disclosed to me, unless the teen's life is at risk. Then I have a legal and moral obligation to report that. So imagine those quandaries, right? And I'm a parent of teenagers, so this is harder and harder as I sit and talk to these kids. I hear something that I know I would want to know if I were their parent, but I can't tell them, even if they ask. In those situations, what I try to do is I offer to help the child tell the parent what the struggle is. I offer to sit in the room and mediate the discussion and help in disclosure and then make recommendations. Several times in my career, I've helped teenage girls tell their parents that they're pregnant. Never an easy task. On one occasion, I was very afraid that the teen's mom would take her home and beat her. I didn't know what to do. I had to send her home. On more than one occasion, I've guided a whole discussion about wise choices, only to listen to the conclusion that abortion is the only tenable option, that conclusion being the child's conclusion. You know what? I must honor their decision, regardless of whether or not I agree. And even when the teens decide to carry the pregnancy, inside my heart, I'm heartbroken because I know often those babies will grow up in poverty, will not be parented, and they have statistically a higher chance of being abused, failing in school, and going on to incarceration. That's not even close to abundant life, is it? Do you see how complicated it is? Those choices are difficult. Neither one is easy for those kids. So how do we add life to a world that's this broken? Is it impossible to affect change when the framework that I work from and the framework that my patients have is different? See, here's where I think we have to go back to the larger story. Because we're united to Christ and we're alive in Him, that's what the Bible says, we, by our very presence, by His presence in us, we add life to those situations with those patients. They may have made the wrong decision, a morally wrong decision, but we can and we should stand by them in their suffering and their consequences, still honoring their humanity by offering the best medical services to them, still offering the best of our relationship with them, crying with them, listening to them, offering them advice. We should not refuse to address issues with them just because they don't share the same moral framework. And the cool thing is, there are so many ways to speak and promote the kingdom without quoting Bible verses. I spend a lot of time talking about respect. I talk about honoring your parents. I talk about wisdom. I talk about forgiveness. I talk about honesty. I talk about truth. I encourage loyalty and character and faithfulness. Is that the same as preaching the gospel? No. But those values do reflect the values of the kingdom and the character of God. And I believe that's a way that God shows common grace in the lives of unbelievers. Do I relish the times when I can talk openly about the gospel? And do I pray for those opportunities to come more often? Of course. Is it complicated? You bet it's complicated. I often feel inadequate to make decisions like these. This week was an especially hard week. I have a family right now with a 14-year-old autistic child, Sammy. Mom and dad are divorced. They hate each other. A month ago, Sammy turned up with bruises. He can't tell what happened to him. He has a limited expressivity, and he always talks about Toy Story. Both parents tell me it's the other parent's fault. Both parents want me to write a letter to the judge talking about the bruises. Both parents say they only have the child's welfare in mind, yet both are ruthless toward the other. Can I tell who's right? Not a chance. Do I sympathize with both? You bet. Do I know what I'm going to do next week? No way. But I know that I can answer the phone. I can let mom talk for an hour, even if I don't have an hour. I can offer to hear dad's side of the story. I can call and speak with the detective and tell the truth about what I know and what I don't know. And I can let Sammy draw all over my exam table and tell me for the millionth time about how he loves Toy Story. And I believe that even without speaking the name of Christ, this is my honor and privilege to serve him by treating those people that he, Christ, has made as though they're his prize for those hours I give to them. And I believe that those actions are both faithful to my calling as a physician and faithful to my witness as a child of God. So how do we continue this day in and day out? Again, if you would have asked me earlier this week, I might have told you it's not worth it. Every morning, I have a dog. It's great to have a dog. Every morning I take him up and I walk him in the park at the end of my block. Every morning there's trash all over and I hate it. But every morning I go up there with the dog and I pick up the trash and throw it away. Because I believe that until Jesus comes, we have to do those same things over and over again. And every morning I ask myself when I look at the park, wow, Jesus didn't come back last night. Look what a mess. But it's a good reminder that in my own life, I need that same kind of grace, and you do too. I need that same kind of renewal. So does it take time to learn about and care for people as people? Yes, it does. It takes extra effort. It's tiring to carry their burdens. It really hurts to see them make the wrong choices. And it's true, sometimes it feels like a waste of time. But I'm reminded when I read my Bible and I see God's faithfulness to his people and I hear testimonies of God's provision in the lives of people I know, that the scope is far wider than what I see on any given day. That my actions and my choices and my life are part of a larger theme of redemption, and that God, by his Holy Spirit, will draw many to him by using my offering of talents and efforts in his service. I'm comforted by the knowledge that the plan is so much bigger, and imminently the answer is God and not me or anything I've figured out. We're going to pass out to you now just sort of a summary of all of this. One is a poem that I wrote a few years ago, and one is a prayer by Oscar Romero, who's an archbishop in El Salvador in 1980, who just has a really great way of putting this bigger picture. And I think Mike's going to read it to you because I always like get too emotional when I do. But that's what I hope, the piece that I wrote, that's what I hope my life stands for. And the piece that Romero wrote is also something that I would stand by as a creed. So Mike's going to read it, and then I'm happy to take questions, except for about Obamacare. I know nothing.
So one thing that I don't think you mentioned is Romero was actually martyred on March 24th, 1980, for his stand for the poor and for the oppressed in El Salvador. And this is a poem attributed to him. It's not Flowers Everywhere, Joy Always. And there's no way that either one of us could make it through that one. So it's on the other side of the page. And it begins like this. It helps now and then to step back and take a long view. The kingdom is not only beyond our efforts, it is even beyond our vision. We accomplish in our lifetime only a tiny fraction of the magnificent enterprise that is God's work. Nothing we do is complete, which is a way of saying that the kingdom always lies beyond us. No statement says all that could be said. No prayer fully expresses our faith. No confession brings perfection. No pastoral visit brings wholeness. No program accomplishes the church's mission. No set of goals and objectives includes everything. This is what we are all about. We plant the seeds that one day will grow. We water seeds already planted, knowing that they hold future promise. We lay foundations that will need further development. We provide yeast that produces far beyond our capabilities. We cannot do everything, and there's a sense of liberation in realizing that. This enables us to do something, and to do it very well. It may be incomplete, but it is a beginning, a step along the way, an opportunity for the Lord's grace to enter and do the rest. We may never see the end results, but that is the difference between the master builder and the worker. We are workers, not master builders. ministers, not messiahs. We are prophets of a future, not our own. Amen. I can. Sure.
All right, we'll take questions if you guys have any, or if that was just so like all inclusive, then we'll just go sit down.
Hello?
Gotcha.
Hello? I don't know if it's...
You asked me last night.
It is? Okay. Can you talk about any criticism you've received from fellow staff or others for your biblical viewpoints on different ethical issues? And also, you mentioned you will try to, you know, bring up things like prayer and, you know, even talking with children about activities, church activities. How do patients respond to that? Are they, do they recoil against that? Or, yeah, can you just talk a little bit about that?
That's a great question. And as far as relating to my colleagues, I don't run around and advertise, this is how I think the world is screwed up or something like that. I spend a lot of time talking about promoting health, wellness, and some of that other language that I would talk to patients about as well. But my colleagues know. I don't know that they know I'm Presbyterian and that I believe the 5 points of Calvinism or whatever. But I think they know that I'm a person of faith and that matters deeply to me. And that my calling is not really just to make the world a better place because, but that I feel that's what God wants for us. As far as patients, it's all over the map. If people are Christians, they get it and they start talking to me, right? If I ask them, what do you do in your spare time? Are you involved in a sport? Are you on debate club? Do you go to youth group? Do you blah, blah, blah? And I have this whole long list. If they're Christians, they latch on to that and they tell me, yeah, I go to this church and I really like it and it's really important and we talk about it, okay? Because then I have freedom to talk. But a lot of people don't even catch that. And if I'm explaining to them, this is how your ear works and this is why you have an ear infection, that's because God made it that way, that goes right over people's heads. Okay, and I think the Bible attributes to that. Some people have dull ears. They cannot hear that, but some people can. And that doesn't mean we should stop saying those things. And I'm always trying to figure out creative ways to poke it in the conversation, right? Because I'm always fishing. I'm always like, who's going to talk back to me? Some lady asked me if I thought she should forgive her. It wasn't her husband, but the man in her life. And I start talking about forgiveness for a little bit, and then she launches into, oh, yeah, I go to church, and God says I should forgive. And then I can go with her, right? But it's always that, this is the challenge I like. It's always looking for that, okay? Some days I'm really tired. I'm not seeing it either, to be honest, because my mind's over somewhere else as well. But it's such a challenge. It's such an adventure, and you never know when things will pop up.
So, for those of us who are fourth years and going into residency, and if you had to go back and look at yourself when you're about to start residency and just the idea of bringing shalom to patients and colleagues and whatnot, is there any advice or anything that you would have done differently or anything that you can kind of impart on us before we leave?
See, I knew all the answers back then, so I knew how to do that. I think the perspective that I relish now is that I know that God uses what I offer him. And it's not my job to bring people to salvation. That's my comfort. My field is medicine. I glorify God by practicing good medicine and using that as an opportunity to add life to people's life, right? So I think that when I started, I thought that a calling into medicine meant that you also had to heal everyone's spiritual issues. Well, you know what? What Romero said, you're planting the seed. And it's so comforting as you get older to know that nothing is wasted. No, I mean, that's what the Bible very clearly says, a cup of cold water. When I hold the door open for somebody, or when I carry somebody's kid because they have too much stuff, none of that is wasted. If because of Jesus in me, not because of the worth of the action, but because I'm his child, right? And that all points forward. So I think if I were starting over, I would love to have a larger sense, because it's really hard in the beginning. You just can't get your feel for how much am I responsible for and how much is God. Well, guess what? It's all God, right? And we're called to live faithful, creative lives and thoughtfully look for ways to add life for the people around us. How's that for like a non-answer?
Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood in Nigeria and how has impacted your perspective here in America?
Yeah, how long do we have? No. So I grew up in Nigeria. My parents were missionaries. They're obviously Americans. I'm obviously an American. But I felt like I didn't fit in, right? Because the culture around me was very, very different. And then when I would come back to the United States, I looked like everybody else, but I didn't feel like everybody else because I didn't really get it. What's the 4th of July all about? I don't know. Like, that makes no sense to me still. So I found like that's hard, not in a spiritual way, but you always had that sense of, do I belong here? I'm not quite like you. I don't resonate to that, but I don't resonate to these people either. The cool thing about that is I think that's what it means to sojourn as Christians in, you know, before Jesus comes back, we're all kind of like that. So the fact that I feel like I don't fit in might have a few extra reasons, but we all kind of share that because that's sort of the way it is. We're not quite ready to be glorified, thank goodness. It's a lot of work to do. But we're not caught in our sin either. We're in that time where we're sojourners, we're travelers, and we do feel a little foreign because it's not complete. So yeah, that's a weird experience. Yeah, I still don't get it sometimes. The other just funny thing was, I have no recollection of pop culture from, I mean, you guys are not old enough for all this, but you know, like Leave It to Beaver and all those kind of things that Mike grew up with, and he knows all that stuff. but I know. Oh, the Brady Bunch, right. So the Brady Bunch would, and the Partridge Family and all that stuff. Like when I came back to go to college, I was like, what? What is that? But I also had this unique perspective of I could see what America looked like to non-Americans. And that was a real gift as well. I was in high school when Ronald Reagan was shot and all the news and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, when you're outside looking in, it's a really different perspective. And it kind of, I think, for me, also helps me now understand what immigrants go through, right? Because they come here, they don't get it either. But I do know how ABBA was, because that was the European music influence. So that's my claim to pop culture, like, you know, ABBA. Somebody else had a question.
Which one do I speak into? Okay. I wasn't here yesterday, so I'm not sure if you already talked about this, but can you talk a little bit about the balance of, you talk about having shalom and bringing peace and adding life to patients' lives, but also the balance of having that own, how necessary it is to have it in your own life and with your own family and friends and relationships?
That's an awesome question, and I had that in this talk, and then I kind of took it out because I can never tell how long anything's going to go. I'm like a bad judge. When you're in medicine, there's a pressure to do more, be more, right? Get there faster, advance your career, write a paper, blah, blah, blah. When Mike and I got married, we very intentionally said that if God gave us a family, we wanted our primary ministry to be to our family. And so the year after residence, the year I stayed as a chief resident at St. Chris, but the year after that, I was pregnant with our twins, and I went to part-time practicing, which is almost unheard of in the academic medicine circle. And I believe it was providential that the chairman of St. Chris at that point in time liked me enough to keep me as a half-time person, because nobody does that. They do that in private practice, but not in academic medicine. So providentially, I was allowed to work part-time for, I'm not even full-time yet, actually, I'm 0.9. But I've been creeping up over the last, 3 years. That's a sacrifice professionally. Like, I've been at my academic rank for way more years than I would like to admit. But I feel like that was a calling on my life to be the mom who could be part of my kids' lives. And I got flack for that. People would say, oh, you just put your kids in daycare and come and do what you're really trained to do. And I'm like, okay, but I'm really good at changing diapers, too. So, and I believe that those parts of your life are really important. It doesn't have to be kids, but it can be involvement in the community. It can be involvement in a church. And you do have to make time for that. A, because I think it will enrich your own life, and B, because now I forgot what B was, but it'll protect you, right? You need a support around you to practice medicine. It doesn't matter if you practice in the suburbs, by the way. This stuff is going to get you wherever you are. So it doesn't matter where you are. It's hard. It's hard to reconcile the brokenness of humanity with the calling of God to spread peace. So you need to set yourself up with a support system, with church, with fellowship, to hold you accountable in that. It really helps to marry someone who knows and is really encouraging and has creative ways to encourage you as well.
So just kind of following up on that, could you share a couple times where the community has kind of had to speak into your life and say, hey, have you thought about this? Has that ever happened?
Mm-hmm. So when I was in, and I spoke about this to my church at Christmas time, the whole notion of when you're seeking peace of Christ, there's that sadness of homesickness, right? And it pops up in your life all the time. And early on in my life, when that would happen, I would always run away from it. Oh, and think, I'm not a good Christian. If I'm doubting God, I'm not a good Christian. I can't do that. But in one time in my intern year, I was called to the bedside of a little child dying of cancer. And nobody should have to die of cancer when you're 3. Right? And nobody's parents should be weeping. The Bible tells us that the ultimate goal is that won't happen. So I'm at this bedside, trying not to cry, but so angry inside. God, how do you let this happen? This is ridiculous. This is not what you want. I know that. But I feel guilty because now I'm mad about it, on top of being sad. Now I'm mad about it. So at that point in time, again, Mike was the voice, the community in my life. And because I felt guilty that I was so angry and outraged that this could happen. And I'm like waving my fist at God, and this is terrible, and now I'm going to lose my faith and all this. And you know what? And Mike said to me, he said, guess what? God is mad too, right? That sense of loss and homesickness is not just a human one. That's a divine one. So that was a reminder for me that longing feeling, and until we get there, you guys, we're all going to live with that. That's not the wrong thing. That's the right thing. But you have to live with that intention, and you have to go forward and still find the joy in service, right? And not just sit around and go, we're in this already, not yet. That stinks, blah, blah, blah. We can't do anything. We have to live with that faith and that joy. And that's what this piece is that I wrote for you guys. These are just stories of my patients and how I come to terms with that. At the end of the day, it's not about me. It's about God's presence in me. And because I'm then with my patients, his presence affects them. It's a mystery. I don't know how it all works, but that's what we're called to. Not knowing the answers, not solving the problems, but being the presence of God in other people's lives.
As a medical educator, I'm just wondering, how do you, I guess, sort of evoke or impress upon students or residents in training this already not yet framework, whether if they are Christian or not, how do you sort of bring that finesse and savvy into it?
That's a really good question, and I don't know that in all of these things, I haven't quite figured this out yet. That's the cool thing about being somewhere for a while is you get to keep trying. I'm much the same with my residents. I ask them about compassion. I ask them about where this person's life is going. I ask them about how they feel toward the patient. And I remind them that we're not better than any of our patients, that we're the same. We're just in a different position. We talk about character. We talk about ethics. We talk about a lot of the same stuff. How do you promote wellness? All that kind of stuff. If I know the person's a Christian, I can take it to a different level. Or if they start asking me questions, a lot of times it's really funny, actually. It comes up because they know that I'm a missionary kid. So that's how it comes up. And then we talk about, well, what were your parents doing there? And what is that? And stuff like that. So that's another avenue for people to ask me questions and for me to open the door a little bit and encourage them.
During your career, did you have any opportunities or events where you were actually able to evangelize or talk about the gospel with your colleagues or that kind of, you know? Were there any opportunities that opened up?
It's interesting because where I work now, there are a few Christians, not a lot. So do I talk about the gospel? I talk about the gospel with my colleagues much the same that I talk about with my patients. I talk about working together to promote values that I think reflect God's character, even though I don't say God's character. We do talk about how we spend our time outside of work. They know I'm involved in a church. I'm involved with Esperanza, which is a faith-based organization. So do I get to directly evangelize? I guess I feel like I'm always poking the questions at them the same way I am for my patients, is trying to feel where they are, trying to talk to them about life and model for them, you know, hopefully a life that points toward peace.
Thanks for your wisdom, Shereen. Wondering if you could just comment on how you deal with the time pressures. Like, there's always more to do. You have a family. You're involved in a ministry. There's always the push to see more patients, do more. Like, how do you take the time to care this way for patients?
So you want to know the honest truth? I pray that half the people won't show up. And I say that tongue-in-cheek, but I often am and on my way to work, and I am saying, because this whole scenario with Sammy, who was abused by somebody, is taking a lot of time. And I don't necessarily have that time. But I literally will pray that God gives me the people that I need for that day and then gives me the patients, because I do run behind all the time. But there are some days when half the patients don't show up, and I don't know why, but I feel like that's not an accident. Right? And I'm always got my ears open, and we're cool. We're so cool now because we're technologically savvy and we can watch who's signing in on our medical record. So if I'm taking a history and I see that five people have signed in for me, I know I can't just keep going. So I try to respect people's time. But if nobody's signed in, man, I'll go an extra 10 minutes talking about what it's like to be a parent. I have a 14-year-old girl who just gave birth. She has no clue. She has no support. She doesn't know anything. She doesn't even know how to clean the baby's diaper, right? So if I know I have time, I stay there with her and I talk her through that kind of stuff. But it's not an exact science. You're right. Everywhere they want you to see more patients, they want you to stay later, all that. But I feel like every day God's in control of that as well. I had a meeting set up the other day. I had way too many things to do that I didn't want to go to that meeting. Well, it got canceled. It was awesome. But I don't believe that's an accident. I believe that God's mercy in our life affects those things. And so we just need to be mindful of that. We need to give him the praise for how he works the details. And then we need to be faithful and have our eyes open and our mouths open and our actions ready to demonstrate his love to other people. I do not do this perfectly every day, by the way, and anyone who works with me can tell you that, and so can my kids, so can my husband. So it's easy for me to tell you all this cool stuff, and you guys are like, whoa, that's so... It's not without struggle, and it's not an exercise in perfection, but the cool thing is, when you take the long view, I'm not the same as I was 10 years ago. I'm better at a lot of this stuff. So God moves you and helps you grow over time.
We have time for one more question, so if anyone's holding back, go ahead and ask one more question.
Thanks, you guys.
Okay. I was holding back your question, so... Hello? Oh, cool. So I kind of wrote down my question as well because I don't remember things. and I'm kind of playing devil's advocate, so I mean, yeah, I'm not sure if you can answer it, but I guess my question, it's like a paragraph long, but so how can we, like my basic question is how can we say the name of Christ, like with our patients? Because like I think, yeah, morals and values are like really great, and like in the end, like it's good that we're like talking about that and like showing them like what God's morals and values are. But if we don't like mention God, like do patients glorify us or do they glorify God? And like also like if patients or colleagues know that we're at church or at small group, like does it glorify us or does it glorify God? And this kind of all goes together because, like, I have, like, friends of mine who have, like, really good morals and values as well. And sometimes they wonder, like, what makes it different, like, what makes them different from me if they also have really good morals and values and that difference is Christ. And so how, like, with patients and colleagues, how do we make that known, especially if they are living, you know, like, really good lives, you know, like... Like, they love people as well, but, yeah, they don't have Christ.
That's the hardest thing, right? You're right, and there's a balance there, and I don't know exactly how to strike that. It's not enough to be a good person. It's not enough to speak kingdom language, even though you're not talking about Christ. I don't know how to do that perfectly. This is the part of the whole thing that's still in play for me. But the comforting part is that the Holy Spirit is drawing those people. And I have had experiences where people will just ask me stuff, right? And then I can go a little further and deeper with them and talk about Christ or whatever it is. You're right, because being a general good person, there's a lot of those. How am I different than that? That's I think a balance between how we live, how we speak, but then what the Holy Spirit's work is as well. And I have seen lots of times in my life where I've been able to give testimony that I didn't even expect because of things that have happened to me, right? And how I narrate the things that have happened to me. I can't think of a good example. But how you tell about that reflects that you believe Oh, I can tell an example. Last night, I was dropping the boys off at the prom, and I had to ride home with somebody else because they took our car. And this family was saying to me how much they appreciate that my boys are the friends of their son. And I said to them, I think it's providential that we went to that same school. And the bigger thing in that relationship was that soccer was the first sport of the year, and both of them played soccer, right? So again, did I say Jesus in that? No, not to that. But I'm trying to narrate my life always to account for the fact that there's bigger than me. And that's an ongoing relationship as well. And I pray that I'll, over time, be able to be more outspoken about what does that mean. Do you see what I'm saying? I don't know the answer. There's a you can't let yourself off the hook. We do need to speak the name of Christ. But there's going to be opportunities, and God will bring those opportunities to you, I believe, if you're faithful in that relationship and you keep building it over time. I know that's sort of a cop-out.
Thank you again so much.
You're welcome.
Could you actually guys come back on stage? So...